All right, so we have in there, I entitled tonight's discussion, Remembering God's Work and Your Calling, Understanding God's Design. Kind of building off of what we looked at last week, we discussed last week as we were considering leadership, we looked at the pitfalls and dangers in ministry that started to come out, and we started to look at various attitudes and things that come out in leaders. And I want to continue that a little bit and then come into our Titus 2 passage, looking at verses 3 through 5, particularly to draw out some characteristics. But as I thought about ministry life in general, I recognize that God has, at times, gives us unique opportunities to minister to others. He may invite you at some point to be a Bible study leader, where you are teaching a group of gals and others to understand God's word. You might be given a responsibility, like you're, you know, as I said last week, we're setting up a women's council to be able to navigate through all the particular needs that comes up within women's ministry. And you might be on that and having to make decisions that impact other people. There'll be various ways in which you will demonstrate some kind of leadership if God is at work in you and through you, giving you those opportunities. And with that comes certain, you know, temptations, certain trials that may sneak up. And oftentimes they're very hard for us to spot what's going on. We know something's going on because there's tension in relationships. You know, when you go into a relationship and there's a tension between two people, you know something is at work in somebody's heart, either in both parties' hearts or in at least one of them, that's causing a tension and difficulty in a relationship. It tends to come up in leadership. There could be an example of somebody who's in leadership deciding that they wanted to make a decision. Let's just say, you know, we want all decaf coffee here. And so this person decides that, you know, I think we should have all decaf coffee. What do you think? And then you start going through and a few people say, yeah, decaf's fine. I'm okay with that. And then somebody should pipe up and foolishly say, no, I'd rather we should have some regular coffee in there. And all of a sudden, now you have this ministry tension going on. Wait a second. I said we should have, decaf coffee. And now you're resisting me. Who are you to oppose me on this? And it wouldn't exactly be stated like that. What would happen is because we'd be sanctified in our behavior, we would say, are you really sure that that's the best? Is that just your opinion? We would try to discredit the other person or talk them down or move on and ignore the suggestion they put out. And before you know it, our own attitudes, our own desires start to rule and reign, and we're no longer in ministry to be servants and shepherds that care for people. We're actually in ministry to kind of guard things and make it look like we want it to look. You know, we want certain comforts we want to keep. And all the time, I'm interacting with the guys, and I'm telling them, look, you're to be leaders, you have certain responsibilities, but you also need to be aware that there's something, when you're given that privilege and opportunity to be a leader, and you're shepherding and ministering to others and caring for needs, there's something that the Lord does, either brings out in you or in others around you. For example, you know, you pour your heart out in study, you labor over a text, and then somebody brushes it off quickly. You know, what happens? How do you respond? If you go to teach and it falls flat on everybody, like everyone's not excited that you just put in all that effort, how's your heart when you head home? Are you still excited that God called you to that task, or now you a bit bitter because, you know, you didn't get the warm reception when you're teaching the way you wanted? What happens is that ministry life exposes some attitudes within God's servants that test us. And again, all the time, I'm telling our men, you guys, you know, need to be careful. And I wanted to take some time to spend some time with you ladies to let you know, because you'll have the same temptations that any of us would have, any guy would have, when you're in those opportunities of leading. And the temptations will be to lead in a way that is less than God's purpose or design. I want to pull out some of these for you. again, as we, because of our Titus passage, I'll just show you real quick and tie it back into this Titus 2 passage. We're looking at Titus 2, 3 through 5, talking about the older women and what they should be doing. And discussing in verse 3, it says they are teaching what is good at the end of verse 3. Verse 4, so that they may encourage the young women. And then he lists a series of exhortations. We'll come back to those. But in both cases, what you had is an older woman put in a position where she has the opportunity to teach and instruct a younger woman. And again, that may be on a one-on-one level, that may be on a much broader level, as God should design and call you with certain gifts and abilities. And when you have those opportunities, the question is ultimately, are you going to be ready for it? Are you going to lead in such a way that is God-honoring? I want to draw some principles out of a book called Exemplary Spiritual Leadership that my uncle wrote a couple years ago. And he has a chapter here on the kinds of leaders that God resists. These are the kinds of qualities within leaders that are those which God resists. The reality is, again, that some of us can be called into ministry and we really want to be there. We're excited about it. We're running to it. And others can be called upon and we're forced into the task of leadership. And we want to know what comes out of our heart. And the first kind of leader that God would resist, that we want to be careful of, that, again, that we're not being, or that others that we're raising up are not being. And then the first elder or leader, I mean, is the one who is a begrudging leader. The kind of person who's begrudgingly in the position of leadership. That is, they're kind of forced there. They got cornered, and now they're forced to be in a spot where they have to lead, and they didn't want to be there. This is the kind of person that even once they get there, they feel stuck, and they can't get out of that particular spot. And when they do, what tends to happen is they become cynical and negative and suspicious in ministry. And when they're forced in that spot, they become, again, cynical of what's going on around them, very negative and critical of others and even of their particular role, and maybe even suspicious that others might be targeting them in some way. Sometimes these particular leaders feel the pressure of being forced into a ministry role, and it comes out. It comes out in their relationship towards others. They're not very gracious, supportive, encouraging. They are very much, again, in it to get the job done and get out, but there isn't a compassion and grace. These are things we want to begin to watch for in ministry, especially if we're called to particular tasks that we're not very excited about. We should be able to assess that in our own heart and life. Why am I even doing this then if I'm not excited about serving the Lord in this way, if I'm not recognizing the Lord's work? If I felt cornered, then who am I talking to develop a strategy to get out of this particular role? You know, it may be that you feel cornered because you don't think that job is sufficient enough. You know, all of a sudden you got called to teach a Sunday school class somewhere with a group of kids and you felt that's way below your talent and ability level. Or, again, you might be called to a kind of people that's hard for you to minister to. And in these cases, these are opportunities where a begrudging leader starts to manifest some of their qualities. And we can't have that within ministry life because you'll see some of the effects. There'll be no joy in what they're doing because they didn't want to be there to begin with. No love, you know, for the people they're ministering to, let alone for the Lord and the work at hand. There may even be, again, a sense of gracelessness when it comes to ministering to people and their faults. It's just like, get over it, you know. I have to be here. I have to be doing things I don't want to do. You have to be it as well. So let's go. Get over it and let's move on. There's just a gracelessness and a lack of mercy when it comes to leading. That person is going to be pretty dangerous in a leadership role because they're not going to project the kind of love that is Christ-honoring. We want to watch for this in our own heart and for the hearts of people we're ministering to. There's also then at times once you get stuck in that role and you recognize that you're pressured and people are depending upon you, but you didn't want to be there, there's an inability to get out because you don't want to lose reputation. You don't want people to think bad of you. You don't want people to, in your particular case, you don't want people to think you less spiritual, and therefore that's why you're getting out. But in those cases, those are need you need to be able to talk to people and work on, you know, developing a plan so that you don't get burned out in a particular area. It's okay to step down for seasons and let other people take on the responsibilities. There may be a time you have to bear that responsibility, but you want to make sure that you're not getting to this point where you're forced to do something and your heart can't be wholly in it. Second quality of a kind of leader that God would reject would be the greedy leader. Now, in your level of service and the opportunities that you have, you probably don't have to worry about this too much. You know, you're not getting paid in cookies or, you know, coffee here. But, you know, it's just the thrill of, you know, service in the body. But the kinds of leaders that we would watch for, maybe, you know, as the ministry grows, and maybe there'd be opportunities to have some kind of speaking honorarium. And this would be the greedy leader would be seeking the work for some kind of personal gain, personal profit. And what happens with the greedy leader, maybe there, you, again, you're not getting paid in money, but maybe getting paid in accolades and respect. And the greedy leader becomes jealous and envious of others around them pretty quickly. They're spiteful and even can be partial in their assessment, because they will be very lax on those who can give them a lot and very heavy on those who cost them something. The greedy leader, again, is evidencing a self-will in their life, and that's what drives them in their everyday activities. These are, again, just things to watch for, and probably not as much of a temptation for us, but something to be careful of in watching leaders. Are they the kind of people who are looking for gain, personal gain? And Jerry had listed out like 10 questions to ask yourself to know if your heart is inclined to riches. And I thought they were very helpful. The first, and I'll just read them real quick. Are you a careful steward of your personal finances? Do you know how to keep a budget? Do you know how to watch your personal finances? Secondly, do you faithfully and joyfully and sacrificially give to the Lord's work? Are you kind that you can be, you know, understanding God's work and giving to it regularly? Do you secretly resent the inconveniences of ministry because you aren't paid enough for the ministry beyond a normal workday? You know, so again, this would be more of a pastoral challenge or an elder challenge, but still it's in our mind. If we think, if there's a sense in your labor or service around, hey, I'm not paid to do this, I'm not going to give it much effort, well, that's already revealing a heart that's in this for a gain other than spiritual reward. And we should be concerned about that. Fourthly, do you find yourself befriending the more well-to-do folk in the congregation? You find those who have means, and you find it easy to befriend them and are not so friendly with the others. Fifth, are you easily consumed by worry and frustration over unseen financial trials? Again, worried, always constantly worried about difficulties of financial pressure. Sixth, do you nervously hover over attendance and giving statistics? I mean, obviously, again, these would be more temptations for elders and other leaders, but the tendency could even be within, you know, a Bible study format. Do you are you attracted to get-rich-quick schemes? Always looking for a quick way to make a buck. Does your ministry demonstrate a vulnerability to church growth fads? Always trying to find a convenient way to attract more people. Or how much do you talk about your material possessions and your financial portfolios? And then lastly, does receiving gifts thrill you more than giving them? And these kinds of responses to these questions could reveal a heart that is attracted to earthly means rather than heavenly riches. And again, in a leadership context, if we're desiring to lead in some way because it profits us, it could profit us materially, or it could profit us in other immaterial ways, and that drives us, we should be concerned about the motives of our heart in that activity. The third way would be a belligerent leader. The third kind of leader that God rejects is the belligerent leader. And, you know, this person can be somebody who is in many ways well-respected and liked, well-disciplined in their life. It could be somebody who is who overall is a fairly nice person until that moment you cross them. And all of a sudden, you know, the hair stands up and the fangs come out and the claws come out and they're just angry and don't like it when someone resists their way. They get domineering and demanding, and, you know, of course they justify it as, this is a good reason. I'm protecting the truth. I'm protecting God's, you know, people or God's message or whatever reason that they have. They justify why they're angry and belligerent, but it comes out in a way of open hostility towards others. Anyone, again, who resists their will, there's an attitude of belligerence. Again, who are you to question me or question this decision? You know, and there's usually kind of a pulling of some card. Well, I'm older than you. I have more life experience than you. I have more training than you. And they pull whatever card they can to demonstrate themselves of having some kind of position or authority that you should follow. These would absolutely destroy spiritual leadership. Why? Why do you think that would cause a problem in spiritual leadership if someone was acting that way? Yeah.
No one would dare confront you if they saw any issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they would dare confront you because they'd get your head ripped off, proverbially speaking. Yeah. Anything else? What else would, why would this be a dangerous leader? We'll keep it a woman in this case for women's ministry, but yes, she could be taking the ladies in the wrong direction. When people were trying to confront and say, "Hey, wait a second," you know, they're resisting. So what is it? What are they demonstrating? They're demonstrating a pride. I know best, and going to resist sound counsel. They're going to seek their own personal will. Which becomes problematic because ultimately we're called to do the Lord's work, not our own. And when people bring to us the truth, you know, we should be humbled before it and brought low before that truth to lead. The third kind of leader, and the next leader that God rejects, is the leader who is intolerant of others. The intolerant of others. You know, you can begin to manifest a frustration over others' weaknesses. You're used to having, you know the charts they talk about, the type A personalities. You know, Jill and I like to say we're type A minus. We're not quite A fully, but, you know, we're not, you know, lax either. So we're like almost A's. But in the regard, you can become, you know, to a point where you get everything in order. That's why I like one of my favorite T-shirts is, you know, I have CDO. You know, the letters are in order as they should be, instead of OCD, right? So, you know, the idea is that you want things a particular way, and then somebody comes along and does it differently, or maybe they can't do it as well as you do. Or they do it in a way, again, that's acceptable and right. It's just not the way you would normally do it. And all of a sudden, you become irritated by them. You know, you don't look the way I do, or you don't talk the way I do, or you don't emphasize the things that I emphasize. And all of a sudden, there becomes this growing intolerance for those people because they're not acting in the way you want them to act. And in, when that happens, there's this frustration, this constant mounting frustration. And this is one of the things that, you know, I watch in individuals will tend to happen when that growing frustration happens, is they'll tend to start throwing out these little jabs, these little comments. That, oh, it's just joking, but it's a little jab here, a little comment there, a little, you know, piece of advice, friendly advice, or just a little, you know, friendly banter that's said, but it just keeps going and going, and it never really stops. You never see the opposite side of someone building up, encouraging. You know, I'm certainly all in for friendly banter when we understand it's friendly banter in a context that's normal for friendly banter, but all the time, it's probably not just friendly banter anymore. And in a serious context, it's not, you know, it's not appropriate. There's a time for everything. So when it's always on, there's probably something else at hand, and these are the things we want to assess. Is there a growing frustration in the people around you because you don't like their maturity level? You don't like their reasoning through things? You don't like their strengths or weaknesses? And if there is that kind of intolerance in the heart, it's going to make it very difficult to lead effectively. And again, this kind of intolerance could certainly be in a male leader. It could be in a female leader as well. It's just something that you want to watch for and start to ask questions. You know, what's going on in my heart? Why is there so much tension here in my personal relationship with this person? What's at work? Because ultimately, I don't want to have something in our relationship that's going to cause a split or difficulty down the road. You know, oftentimes, you know, people will say in this, as they're growing frustrated with somebody's weakness, and the weakness can be many things. It could be some people, as I like to say, there are two kinds of people in the world. There's people who talk when they have a point, and there are people who talk until they have a point. Right? You have both kinds of people out there. And if you're the opposite of that, you can be frustrated. You know, the kind of person who's talking and just keeps going until they have that point they want to make. If you're the quiet, contemplative type, it really gets to you. I know that because I am that, right? So I'm the one who just likes to think and carefully assess what I want to say and say. And if I could say it in a pithy way, it takes me a second to say it, great. That's the best. Then there are the other side of those who want a long novel, and if I haven't, you know, if it takes me, you know, an hour, then I think I finally got it after an hour of communicating, and, you know, well, that can be hard for the other personality type. And what will happen in the other personality type when they see something they don't like in the individual, they'll begin to think, you know, I'm just going to let them have it. You know, I'm going to tell them exactly what's on my mind and let them have it, because after all, they need to know this truth. They need to get it. And so we send that direct and sharp barb at that person to cut them down, or, you know, to get the truth off of your, you know, off your chest. Let them have it. And, you know, and our own justification in that is, well, I was giving them the truth. You know, it was right. And we fail to recognize, again, that there is the responsibility that even in communicating the truth, it must be done in grace. It must be, you know, as Ephesians 4:29 says, letting no unwholesome word proceed from your mouth, but only such a word is good for edification according to the need of the moment, that it would give grace to those who hear. Those who receive that message have to be built up and edified. You know, I'm forced, as by very the nature of Christian love, to try to build up and love that person and see them mature as a result of what I share. But if I'm intolerant of that person, if there's something I don't like about them and it's really, you know, weighing on me, it's going to come out in those comments and those jabs. And those are things we really want to be careful to watch for. If you just find those words slipping out of your mouth and you're leaving later and you're feeling a little convicted, it's like, why did I just say that there? Well, maybe you need to start analyzing what your own general perspective towards that person and their strengths and weaknesses are. Because ultimately, we don't want to justify sinful behaviors when we're dealing with others. Questions or comments so far? Good. Moving on to the arrogant and joyless leader. Here's the kind of leader that God rejects as an arrogant and joyless leader. And again, these kind of leaders start to demonstrate anger. You know, they're angry leaders. They have personal agenda. They may even resist God's sovereign purposes in ministry. You know, you might start ministering in a particular way, and God's sovereignty happens in an event, and His providence is directing, and it squashes this leader's plan, this perfect plan that they put together, and they become angry because it's not working the way they wanted it. You know, we designed an outreach for, you know, everyone to be here on, you know, October 31st, we're going to reach the whole world for Christ, and 10 people showed up, and we're angry that it's not working the way we wanted it to work, and we start to take out a frustration on the people around us. You didn't help out. You didn't commit. You didn't, on and on. Instead of recognizing God directs hearts and people, and want to be thankful for whatever level of ministry He gives us. There needs to be joy that flows out of our ministry pursuits. And if there's an angry, proud way within our leadership, it's going to manifest itself in people under us who are afraid to share anything with us, and afraid to ask for our help because we're, again, dominant in our pursuits. And as well, there's sometimes, in some of our, our personalities, the kinds of people who are more quiet, contemplative types, we can get very serious and, driven. I got this task and this task next, and we don't demonstrate, there's also to be a joy in our work, and it should come out in some expression on our face and our communication with others, and we should work hard to demonstrate that joy. If we're not joyful and, humble in our service, that kind of leadership isn't going to be very healthy amongst God's people. The next kind of leadership that fails and would be a hindrance to the church would be self-righteous and judgmental attitudes. Again, this is the person who does everything perfect in their own life and nobody else can attain to it. They've got everything nailed. They've never made a mistake in their life. They are perfect in all of their instructions. And if they should happen to be found in error, it's probably because the commentary was wrong, not because they were at that moment. And this self-righteous leader builds themselves up by promoting themselves. They're also kind of easily provoked to anger. They are prone to bitterness and unforgiveness because, again, they're right. And when somebody transgresses them in some way, they just can't tolerate it. So they'll push back. And you really just want to spot, is this somebody really hard to interact with? I mean, are they hard to have a conversation with? Are they hard? Does everyone just tend to have to walk on eggshells around them? If they do, that's problematic. As Jerry points out, it says, lurking behind angry tantrums are the ugly idols of reputation, personal rights, and revenge. Bitterness and anger say, I deserve to be treated as I please. My reputation matters most. My expectations will be met or else. These are dangerous qualities in any kind of leader, and you most certainly wouldn't want them manifested among the ladies in leadership here at the church. You wouldn't want it in your own heart. It would be something that you would want to assess. And then lastly, is the a leader who's conceited and insecure. It is always interesting to me to watch the kind of person who's always asking for affirmation. Hey, how did I do there? What happened? Did I do good enough? And it's constantly going around to everybody every week. How did I do? And have their list of, 20 people that they like to talk to draw out. And, as soon as you say something negative, I'll cut you off the list and add someone else to my list. And I'll find my 20 favorite people who always share something good and that will keep me going. The insecure leader, again, is looking for majority rule and always looking for the positive affirmation to make any kind of spiritual decisions. And that's going to be problematic within ministry. Because the reality is, we're not going to please everyone. I don't even please myself every time when I make a decision. There are times that, where you're forced to make a decision between two, difficult choices. And neither one would be the one you'd want to choose, but one has to be chosen. You have to go down it. Those things happen all the time within the complexities of ministry, and we just have to navigate through that. I mean, think about our ministry here. There's so many needs around, and you have to decide, well, what are we going to put the best effort into? And you got between kids ministry polling and women's ministry polling and the regular worship service and everything else, the facility needs. Like, well, look, everything can't be met. So we're going to have to pick our best and our most important and put our effort in it. Well, the conceited leader, the insecure leader, is then going to be unnerved when somebody's pet project isn't invested in and they come marching over and let them know it. Oh no, we, made somebody upset because we didn't do what they wanted and now we're trying to seek their approval. Well, if we do that, then ministry is never going to be accomplished because we're constantly trying to please the people around. And what happens is people learn, well, if my pet project didn't get invested in, all I have to do is raise an alarm and then they will respond and do what I want done. And that's going to be difficult for the ministry. So ultimately, I bring those out because as you lead in whatever context, you want to make sure you don't have those kind of qualities in your own heart and life, that you guard against it. And then if you see it in the leaders that God brings up, that you call them to account. You ask them to think carefully about the attitudes that they're projecting and remind them that this work of service is a spiritual work that Christ analyzes and watches, Christ enables us, and it's ultimately Christ's message. We're his servants as we're doing the work. Whatever level of ministry we're called to, it's always service unto Christ. And so in that process, we want to make sure that we're not self-willed in that pursuit. Thoughts or comments on that before we jump into Titus? Any questions? Excellent. So now back to Titus, Titus 2. What is it that God would call us to then for the gals? And I've thought about this for a while in this particular passage in Titus 2. What I like about this passage is Paul is giving some exhortations to the church and he's really telling Titus here how to establish a church and get the various ministries and church in line. Because notice you had the elders in chapter 1, you have older men, and then you go into older women and younger women, and then you have the instructions for younger men, and then you go into slaves. And he's laying everything out in order of how everyone's to conduct themselves so that ministry life is conducting itself properly in the church. And you can see this as an elder, rule in the church. You have then men's ministry, women's ministry, and you have then this group called slaves or servants being called to various responsibilities. And in this then, what I've recognized that here in Titus 2 is that if there's ever a point within ladies' ministry where you're deciding, what should we do next? That really Titus 2, 3 through 5 becomes the anchor point by which all other ministries spring out of. As if, you could never over communicate these ideas and these responsibilities. Among you ladies, the exhortation to one another, to lift one another up, to carry out these qualities, is what Paul says was important for the churches there in Crete. They were to make sure that they were operating. In these cases, you had older women who are operating themselves in such a way that would be worthy of following. And I think this is important for us as a church, that no matter any area of ministry and evaluating, should we get involved in this ministry? Should we get involved in this study? Does it help you accomplish the objectives laid out here in Titus 2, 3 through 5? Does it help older women to operate in a way that represents the characters we'll get at in a minute? Does it also help women, younger women, operate with the kind of character they should have? If it does, that's the kind of ministry that you should be engaged in. Because as I thought about this, I can understand these things in theory, right? And I can understand a woman's role in theory. I can even teach it in doctrine. I've taught through Ephesians 5 and talked about men's roles, women's roles, and role of wife and husband, etc. I understand all of this in theory. What I don't understand is any of this in practice, right? I'm never going to be a wife. That is just it. I'm never going to understand it in practice. But you will all the time. You live in this. Most of you. You understand the ins and outs and the difficulties of these things, and therefore can offer unique advice, insight, encouragement, and help. And you do face difficult challenges. You know, you do face the unique challenge of, you know, what happens if your husband is disobedient to the truth? You know, how do you work through those difficulties? What happens when you are, you're doing what's right and you're pursuing what's right, but the people around you are not, and making it more difficult for you? The temptation in the heart to say, I'm just going to give up. They're not trying. I don't have to try. And that's where you need other people around you to help lift you up and encourage you to do what's right. Other times maybe that you might be slacking in an area. You might be not fulfilling the particular God-given role, and you need another lady who's to come alongside of you who is doing it and saying, look, you need to pick up the pace a little bit in this area and get better. That's why, again, this particular passage becomes really an anchor for you in regards to God's design and purpose for you. So what is God's design? Well, let's look at older women first. Older women, as he says in verse 3. The question would be, well, what does that mean, older women? And the likelihood that the older women here would relate to what Paul said in 1 Timothy 5:19 or 5:9. It says in 1 Timothy 5:9, it says, a widow is to be put on the list, notice, only if she is not less than 60 years old, having been the wife of one man. The likelihood here, the older woman would be somebody 60 years and older, somebody who's been at life for a while, and is, and in this case, it would be somebody who has a fair reputation. What kind of reputation? Well, the kind of reputation that makes them reverent in their behavior. This is, in fact, the only time in the New Testament this word is used. In fact, a few of these words here in Paul's description are only times used in the New Testament or in this particular text, which make it kind of hard to find a New Testament explanation. But this idea of reverent in behavior is one who is godly and holy in their conduct. It was described, as one guy stated it, one who carries herself with a state of priestliness, someone who's regularly serving, regularly caring for, and ministering to others. That's the reverent in behavior. And the likelihood is the kind of model example would be Anna in Luke chapter 2, verse 37 and 38. Remember Anna, she's at the temple waiting for the Messiah to come. So she's just regularly serving. And God had kind of told her at some point that she was going to see the Messiah. And finally, baby Jesus comes in and she sees the child and rejoices. And then from there on out, it says, Luke records, she told everybody. As she was serving there in the temple life. And so this person with reverent behavior is a godly person who conducts himself in a stately way that is directing towards that which is holy and good. So we're saying an older woman pursuing good things. She must also, the older women, must not be a malicious gossip or malicious gossiping. That is, they're the kind of person who refuses to listen to or propagate sinful speech. You're not going to listen to something and you're not going to spread it on to others. You're not going to engage in malicious gossip, which would be this, the kind of speech that seeks to tear down others, to highlight a weakness in somebody and to tear them down and to expose them. And the question would be then, how do you know when you're engaged in some kind of gossip and communication? How do you know when you're engaged in that? Yeah.
Maybe you have to look at your motive for speaking that way. What is driving you to speak those things of someone? Are you truly seeking help? Mm-hmm.
Just kind of vent, yeah. Yeah, that attitude motive, the motive of the heart. Am I just trying to let people know, or am I actually trying to seek help? Anything else? Yeah, Jasmine? Mm-hmm. If there's something that you wouldn't share in front of them, but you gladly share privately, it's likely that it's gossiping. The key in this gossip is that you are you're not seeking the individual's help. You're only seeking to reveal or expose that person. So that is that if I had a, you know, somebody had a difficulty, you know, with another individual, and they tried to work with them but couldn't make any progress, and they went to a spiritual leader in the church and said, here's what's going on. Well, in that case, it's not gossip, right? Because they're seeking somebody's help to engage in the conversation. But if they went to somebody else who wasn't a spiritual leader, engaging them and informing them, well, it would become gossip at that point because that person isn't able to help. The point is that it becomes gossip when I am tearing them down, not concerned about building them up, revealing their weaknesses, and painting them in a negative way to somebody else. But what's rather interesting about this word, it has more than that, because this word is diabolos, which is the word we get devil from. And it is the idea of lying about somebody. This is the kind of person who actually takes something about somebody and twists it and presents a false picture to somebody else. That's why the adjective malicious gossips. This is somebody seeking to tear down and destroy. Gossiping, again, is sharing information about somebody to somebody else who isn't able to help. Where a malicious gossip is now lying about somebody to tear that person down and make them look bad in somebody else's eyes. And that's saying that's not to be part of our MO. We're not a slanderers. We're not false accusers. We're not liars. We're not trying to make people look bad. And this is what we want to, you know, our older women to conduct themselves in such a way that they're not acting like this. Also interesting along these lines. If you turn back to that 1 Timothy 5, I just want to point out one thing. And Paul says about the widows, you know, in verse 9, again, they're not to be less than 60 years old, having been the wife of one man, having a reputation for good works, and if she has brought up children, if she has shown hospitality to strangers, if she has washed the saints' feet, if she has assisted those in distress, and if she has devoted herself to every good work. He lays out the qualities for the widow before she's a widow indeed and recognized to be on the list. But notice how he describes the younger ladies who are widowed. Verse 11, but refuse to put younger widows on the list. For when they feel sensual desires in disregard of Christ, they want to get married, and thus incurring condemnation because they have set aside their previous pledge. So the idea here within the pursuit of widows is that they were to be provided for by the church so that they could commit themselves to serving in church life. And that's, you know, so an older gal who gets to this point, who's be cared for by the church, is also committing themselves to caring for the church. So this is why we're saying we don't choose a younger gal, because she's to pursue, getting married. That's why, notice what he says in verse 13. Here's the key I wanted to draw your attention to. It says, at the same time, they also learn to be idle, as they go around from house to house, not merely idle, but also gossips and busybodies, talking about things not proper to mention. So what happens? They, with all of their free time now, that they're set up and engaged to be involved in ministry life, instead of being involved in the service, they end up walking around becoming gossips and busybodies, using their free time to just spread information about other people. This is a particular danger. Even earlier in 1 Timothy, if you'll notice, in 1 Timothy 3, talking about deacons and elders. You know, in 1 through 7, he gives the descriptions of elders. And then in verses 8 through 13, he gives descriptions for deacons, and he's describing the qualities of deacons. Now, what's interesting about these qualities is that I believe the way he's breaking up verses 8 through 13, he does this. He is describing what I would understand and have taught. He would describing deacons, and he describes women deacons and men as deacons. And what he gives in verses 8 and 9 are descriptions of of deacons that apply to everyone universally, both men and women. What are those qualities? Again, they have dignity, not double-tongued, not addicted to much wine or fond of sordid gain. Verse 9, they're holding to the mystery of the faith with a clear conscience. All of those, whether you're a man or a woman, functioning as a role of deacon, doesn't matter. You are to have these qualities. But then notice verse 10. He narrows down the focus to men. These men must also be tested. Let them serve as deacons if they are beyond reproach. And then verse 11, notice this, or actually verse 10, the word men there isn't in the original, is added in our translation. So verses 8, 9, and 10 refer to all deacons, whether a man or a woman. They are to be tested, verified. But then he splits out and he gives unique qualities for temptations for women and unique qualities for temptations for men. Verse 11 are the women. Women likewise must be dignified, not malicious gossips, but temperate, faithful in all things. These are the unique temptations for women. They could be malicious gossips. And then verse 12, you see the unique temptations for men. They must be husbands of only one wife. Woman can't do that, obviously. This is only uniquely for a man. He must be a good manager of his children in their own household. So what I want to point your attention to in all this is that there are unique personal temptations that you will face as women that you have to be aware of and guard against. And that significant temptation is that of being a malicious gossip, a gossiper, a busybody who's going around gathering information and then going out and sharing with somebody else and just taking that little nugget and sharing with everyone around and then starting over and doing it again. And what happens along the way is you begin to find those juicy morsels that everyone wants to hear about and wants to understand and will listen to your story intently. And what happens along the way is you start to tear down and assassinate the character of somebody else. And Paul's saying here, that's not a dignified character. That's not what we're to pursue. That's not the kind of person we want to be following. And it's not the kind of person who should be leading in the church. She cannot be a malicious gossiper. Can't be tearing down. And in particular, you ladies should be careful because that's a unique temptation that you're prone to. Questions or comments about that? Yeah. Right.
You're still the older woman, mm-hmm. Not like a set.
Right. I'm just speaking in a general sense. We would recognize in a discipleship way that anyone older in age, life experience, spiritual maturity could offer discipleship and involvement in others. But he's just kind of, again, laying down some general principles. But yes, it would not be wrong. Someone can say, well, you know, you're not 60, so you have nothing to share me. Share to me. I mean, we'd be in trouble if that was the case. But as a general guideline, this is what we're stating here. Again, my concern is somebody saying, well, I'm 22 years old and I'm the older woman because I got the 18-year-old. Well, yeah, you know, you're basically peers. You know, that the point is that the older person here has some life experience. It's not just knowledge and understanding. It's not just some, but there's life experience that couples that. They've been through, life a little bit. They've bore children. They have carried responsibility. They've gone through the difficult conversations. They know what it is to work through an argument with their spouse. They know what it means to labor without any awareness, you know, all of those things. So that's what we're wanting to highlight. Mary?
Just the other thing, knowing how women like to talk, I mean, we like fellowship and, mm-hmm. And when I pray these verses for myself, I let my mind wander back to James and about the tongue being like a fire. Mm. And how we can just so naturally,
yeah.
Bad things roll off our tongue. So
yep.
It's interesting how many different places he talks about them. Women and malicious gossips.
Right.
Like to talk.
Yeah.
We have to really guard carefully.
in a multitude of words, there's ruin, and you know the proverbs say, yeah. Oh man, I got to speed up here. Okay, so the next one is one who's not enslaved to much wine, as it describes a older woman. This idea here again is one who is not given to drunkenness. You know, and it's easier to cross this line than we think. It's easier to get to that line of drunkenness. And, you know, I remember teaching through the Ephesians 5 passage, do not get drunk with wine, but be filled with the Spirit. In talking about this temptation, it's easy to fall into a pattern of drinking because in some sense, you know, drinking helps suppress those depressed feelings. Drinking helps to overcome loneliness. Drinking can be used to even suppress various frustrations. And if you're not careful and you're turning to the bottle for these things rather than to spiritual, you know, pursuits, you can cross that line of drunkenness very easy. And what's happening here is one who is not a drunkard is literally the idea here. And I could just say, you know, briefly, you know, it isn't saying you cannot have a drink. It is saying you cannot be a drunkard, one who is given into drinking. But I can say, though, as a practice for our own ministry life, we have, as leaders in the church, decided not to, and we've, you know, covenanted together not to engage in, you know, in drinking. Why? Just because we don't want the temptation and don't want the, you know, with our culture, the way it's heading, anyone to see us enjoying a liberty and say, ah, well, they can drink, so then we can, and now it justifies their excess. So in this case, what we're called to is somebody who is temperate and controlled with how they handle their Christian liberties, and they don't cross the line. They're not gone into the line of drunkenness. So the line, again, is the point we've fallen into drunkenness. You say, where is that? That's where I personally like to say, well, the line is the legal line of drunkenness. What's that? The 0.08 scale. If you blow a 0.08, you are, when you're driving, you're a DUI. That's legally drunk. So there's your line. And there are studies out there for how quickly it takes to get there with the various kinds of alcohol out there. It could be easier for one drink or another. It could be easier based on the time of month for you, but based on how much food you've had beforehand, all these other factors. And I think it's just best not to be around it at all, but each of you on your own make your decision. Questions, comments about that, as I just throw that out there? You can't call me a liberal because I say don't drink, but you can't call me a legalist because I said it's okay as long as you're not drunk. Yeah.
Could this also be applied to other addictive habits?
Anything that would control you. Yeah. So anything that would, where you lose, well, anything, taking any kind of possession or any kind of chemical that would control you.
So you think it applies mostly to just chemical addictions?
Yeah. In this context, that would be different. Okay. Different reasons for, you know, immorality or whatever, the internet kind of stuff, or even greed. There'd be different reasons we'd go to say they're disqualified. Quickly, because we're out of time. We're so out of time and I have a lot to do. So, I'm just going to finish the older women. I'll pick up with the younger women next week so I don't shortchange any of you younger ladies in the joy of knowing your responsibility. But notice again when they say, he says that you are to be teaching what is good. They are, again, not enslaved to much wine, but teaching what is good. And in this, the idea is they're teaching what's holy, they're teaching what's right, those things that are consistent with sound doctrine. This is the kind of instruction they have is the kind of instruction that is God-honoring, God-pursuing, that helps people to get a proper perspective of their life and difficulties. You know, I mean, that's constantly our battle in life. Our constant battle in life is getting God's perspective on the difficulties and circumstances we're in. We know our perspective because we're warring with it and we're wrestling with it. But understanding God's perspective on those difficulties is oftentimes what we need help with. And we can read the scriptures, and sometimes it's hard for us to make the connection between what the scriptures say and what our problem is. And so having an older person come along and point out, here's the connection and here's the truth, here's what you need to consider, is what we need in the midst of those difficulties. I mean, it's easy for us to understand God is good, that God's in control of all things, that God's directing all of our circumstances, that He's in control of every unique circumstance and nothing has happened outside of His design. It's easier for us to understand that concept. It's hard to understand it in the midst of the difficulty when we're saying, but how did I get this flat tire at this place, at this time at night, with these kids in the back car? You know, it's a... The follow-up? Okay, how is it that, again, in these difficult times, to be able to get God's perspective in the midst of that difficulty is difficult? And somebody come along saying, you know, God is good in this, and even He brought to you, and He start pointing out various things that God did in that circumstance to bring you out of that difficulty, or to teach you more about His character, or to protect you. All of those things, that's what we need. And again, I think this is the distinction between in 1 John, when John says, in 1 John 2, he talks about the little child, and he talks about the young men, and then he talks about the fathers. And then the distinction is that the little child knows that their sins are forgiven. They're just reminded their sins are forgiven. The young man is the one who is able to refute the evil one. He's the one who is able to confront with doctrine and expose error. So he knows his sins are forgiven, but he's also kind of doctrinally sound. He knows what's right. Well, the father is the one, again, who knows him who's from the beginning. That is, that he has the understanding that his sins are forgiven. He has the ability to doctrinally refute error, but he goes one step further and knows intimately God. Then in the midst of the trial and difficulty, God is there with them. He's been through the trials and difficulties a few times, and he knows God isn't going to leave him. That's a father. That's a mature person. That's somebody who's godly, that they've been through the trials and difficulties and can say, once again, I don't know how, I don't know when, I don't know what God is going to do, but He is going to do something to deliver us through this, because he is always protecting His godly people. And that's the kind of instruction that is good, consistent with sound doctrine, that's holy and right, the kind of things that should be on the lips of our older women. And I will beat the younger women up next week in that, I guess. Comments or thoughts on that? All right, well, we'll keep praying for God to raise up the older women here. So let me pray for us. Father, thank you for these things and for your work. And we do pray that you continue to raise up at Saving Grace Bible Church those ladies who would be walking with you, that they would be using their position as older women to encourage and exhort the younger women. They, in their own lifetime, as they've submitted themselves wholeheartedly to the truth, that they would find encouragement in walking in your ways. And Father, give us wisdom. If we are to see an older woman faults and difficulties, give us the wisdom to come alongside of them, encourage them, appeal to them to do what's right, and protect any gal that you would raise up to lead in some way in this church. Help them to be faithful in their pursuits, that they would ultimately find their joy in doing your work and find their satisfaction in whatever reward you should decide to give them. Thank you for everything you've given us. It's in Christ's name we pray. Amen.